Amen. Morning, men. Great to be back with you. And per Jeff's announcing that I was giving the message this morning, I'm actually very impressed. It's about twice as many as I thought that would be here. The title of my message this morning is How Do You See It? Our text is a familiar one, 1 Samuel 17. I want to take a fresh look at one of the greatest stories ever told, the story of David and Goliath. Sometimes things are not what they seem to be. And I think I've told this story before. I don't know if I've told it here, but it fits well with kind of the beginning of this story of David and Goliath, where when I a lot of people will ask me sometimes, what was your welcome to the NFL moment? And most guys, if you ask that question, they give some, you know, great story of how some guy came out of nowhere and took their head off and it was a hit like they've never experienced in collegiate football, and that was their welcome to the NFL moment. Mine's a little bit different. It was first game. The only reason I knew I'd made the team was I was still there. Nobody said, you've made the team. And there on the sideline, not being playing in some special teams, and right in front of me, probably about 10 yards in front of it, a flag comes out and the call's really, really close. Could have gone either way, but it went against us. And I witnessed something that I couldn't believe my eyes. Because for 7 weeks, Hank Stram was the coach. And for 7 weeks, two practices a day, I had watched him and how he acted, interacted with everyone in the field of practice and play. And he takes off the sideline. And Billy Martin style, he is in that referee's face. No foul language, but his arms are flying and he is screaming and yelling. And I'm like, whoa, that is something else. And when he steps back, he kind of steps back like this, and he steps almost on my foot. He's standing right next to me. And I thought, you know, do I say something? It's like, no, rookie, you keep your mouth shut. And we stay there for a little bit, and pretty soon he swings his elbow around, hits me in the stomach, looks like this. I was pretty good, wasn't I? Yeah. So that's my welcome to the NFL moment.
Yeah.
Like my welcome to the NFL story, David's welcome to the mighty army of Israel story is not quite what he imagined. Turn with me to 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel 17, we'll begin reading at verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Sukkot in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes-Damim between Sukkot and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the Valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another with the valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 125 pounds. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 15 pounds. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time, he was very old. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The firstborn was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, 6 weeks, the Philistine Goliath came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Now skip ahead to verse 32.
Oh, Bill.
Don't worry about this Philistine, David told Saul. I'll go fight him. Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him.
I sent you the link on email.
A warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping your father's sheep."
Bill, do you have the link?
Keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it.
Everybody else is on that.
When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be just like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on the sword over his tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. "I can't go in these," he said to Saul. "I'm not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream and put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, Goliath, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was a little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" The Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." Then David said to the Philistine, and this is some good Old Testament trash talk right here. "You come against me with a sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled. Today the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." When the Philistines moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly to the battle line to meet him. Reaching in his bag, he took out a stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down Goliath and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from its sheath. After he killed him, he cut off his head with a sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. I'm sure many of you have read or heard of Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath. Maybe you've seen some of the TED Talks clips of that where he's given a story. What he did is kind of interesting. He kind of flipped the script in saying that if you know some of the facts that were probably in play, that actually David was not as much of the underdog as you would think, and Goliath was not as mighty and terrorizing by comparison as you might think. He first talks about that with David as it relates to the sling. You know, it's not a little slingshot. It's in this case what a long band with a pouch, and they would whirl that at really, really high speeds, let go of one of the strands, and that projectile would go, he said, twice. It was equivalent, the stopping power was equivalent to a 45 caliber handgun, and talked about how slingers, like archers, were those that were very, very skilled and practiced at doing what they did. They could actually hit a target over 200 yards away. And they could actually hit a bird in flight. So very, very skilled. And then flipping that to Goliath, there's reasonable evidence that he was somewhat handicapped in the sense that giantism then and today is called acromegaly, brought on by a benign tumor of the pituitary gland. It causes an overproduction of human growth hormone. And the symptoms are double vision and profound nearsightedness. And he points out things in the story, like when he says, "You come at me with sticks," and David just has a staff. He has one stick. So maybe he's kind of seeing things a little bit odd. So it's interesting and fascinating to go through that. Now, All that said, I think the situation is not as extreme on either end. In other words, David was not the inexperienced boy shooting at the giant with a rubber band slingshot like I used to break so many windows as a kid. And Abraham might have needed corrective, you know, contacts to see better, but he was, as it says, a formidable warrior of renown. In summarizing the part of the story that we didn't read, David shows up and he overhears something. He overhears what is promised. And I love to read between the lines and think through this. You know, there are three things he hears that are being promised to the one that would fight this giant. One is great wealth. That's good. Second, the king's daughter in marriage. Could be good. You know, he doesn't know, but it's possible. But the third one sealed the deal. No taxes for you and your family for the rest of your life. Okay, I'm in, you know. Risky, yeah, but that's too much to turn down. Then we get into the sibling rivalry. You know, David's oldest brother, it shows, is seriously jealous, and he angrily mocks him. But I love David's response to him. What have I done now? I was just asking a question. And then he just walks away and ignores him. Great. One of my favorite parts of the story is where David puts on Saul's armor. Here's Saul, and we can so easily leave him out of this story. Saul is like the big, are you kidding me? Saul, it was said, is probably about my height, 6'6", 6'7". He was clearly in the, you know, it would be estimated in that army, he was the warrior of renown of his army. He was the one that should have gone out immediately and fight. But no, he's not. And now he's actually taking his armor, which is ridiculous, and putting it on David. And David's like, no, I don't think so, you know, and takes it off. No, I can't go in these. And then, and because he's not used to them, and we go from there. So this morning, I want to look at this story, not so much focusing on David and Goliath, but rather on Saul, the king of Israel, and the entire army of fighting men wringing their hands and wetting their pants in fear, repeating this every day for 40 days and refusing to get in the fight. To which I ask, what's up with that? I staff here as pastor to the 20s and 30s group in 2013 for 5 years. Made a brief stop at Leading the Way, and then taught Bible at a Christian private school for 4 years. From that experience, I can tell you definitively and regrettably that we have a huge number of Christian young people. We have a huge generation of young people who, faced with the same scenario as depicted with David and Goliath, that is, an evil army threatening to destroy the nation, would do the exact same thing as the army of Israel did. Nothing. They would sit on their hands and they would refuse to fight. They would say, we'll pray for you. We'll share the gospel with you, but we're not going to pick up any rocks and enter into the conflict. I often hear this contextualized as we as Christians should stay out of politics. When you say that, you step right into Satan's trap. That's his deception. One of Satan's masterful art of war tactics is to make everything political, knowing that he can then depend on the "we don't want to be political" Christians to sit on the sidelines. What's happening today is not political. It's evil. It's straight from the pit of hell. Human trafficking is not political. Illegal immigration is not political. Not punishing criminals is not political. Murder is not political. Preying on the innocence of our children is not political. Lying to and surgically mutilating young people is not political. Pedophilia and pornography is not political. Punishing people who refuse to call evil good and good evil is not political. Demanding that people deny proven scientific truth and facts is not political. It's evil, and it will destroy our civilization. It seems like every day another agent of Satan steps out and trash talks the living God, holding out double-fisted middle fingers mocking all that is good, all that is decent and healthy for society. And what are we supposed to do? How do you see it? I'll tell you how I see it. I see it differently. Like David, I ask, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? The Lord has delivered us in the past from those who attempted to defeat us and tear us apart as a nation, and I believe he can do it again. The only difference between then and now is that most of the enemy attacks in the past were from the outside in. Today, these are coming from within. They're just as evil and just as destructive, and the goal is the same, capture and destroy. And trust me, they're going to win unless those of us who say we believe in God and goodness and truth and beauty and the law and morality don't stand up and fight. So I'm going to pray, and I'm going to take every opportunity to give a reason for the hope that I have in Christ, but I'm also going to fight for all it's worth, if not for me, for my children and my grandchildren. Here's how I see it. It's not an either or. It's an and too. It's not that as a child of God, I'm to just focus on God's kingdom and sharing the gospel. I also love my neighbors, my neighborhood. I love my city, my schools, my state, my country, and fight the enemies trying to conquer them. Maybe I'm naive, but I believe I can do two things at once. I can love God and fight evil. I can believe in and long for the new heaven and the new earth and fight for all that's good and right on the earth that I'm currently living on. Like Jesus, I'm to promote and love all that is good and hate and call out all that is evil and bad. Jesus obliterated the idea of that Christians should be pacifists when he made a whip and personally drove out of the temple courts those who were exploiting the poor. Jesus gave us some New Testament smack talk with how he spoke to the religious rulers, which were the political equivalent of our government officials today. Hypocrites, blind fools, blind guides, whitewashed tombs full of dead men's bones, straining out a gnat but swallowing a camel, you snakes, you brood of vipers. How will you escape being condemned to hell? Why don't you say what you really think, Jesus? The popular saying, God helps those who help themselves, is not biblical. And though it has a ring of truth, it's problematic, especially as it relates to salvation, where God only helps those who cannot in any way help themselves. The more biblically accurate saying would be, God expects us to do our part. And we see many examples of that in Scripture. When I was very young, 9, 10 years old, we would go to church and I would hear a 25, 30, 35 minute message, got home and couldn't even remember what was said. We had a rule in our home, there was no TV on Sunday, which was crazy because all of the good TV was on Sunday back at that time. I mean, really. But that's fine. If it was a nice day, we were out playing baseball or do something as a family. But rainy, not so nice day, we had a console radio, and I would sit in front of that radio, and I would listen to incredible speakers like Billy Graham and these different speakers, and they only talked for 15, 20 minutes, but I could remember everything they said. They were masters at the art. And so I just felt at a very young age that God was calling me to be a preacher. I was going to be a preacher. And to my parents' credit and my siblings' credit, I made a little podium out of wood, and we would go down in the pasture on a Sunday. And I'd, bring some benches, and I would preach a message that I had prepared. You get to heaven if there's cows and sheep. I led them to the Lord. Yeah. I mean, we do the altar call and the whole bit. But I had a problem, with that calling. I stuttered. In elementary school, I had to stay 2 to 3 times a week, would go in the Quonset hut and meet with the speech therapist and work through all of that. I got to the point where I could manage things pretty well conversationally because I knew certain words tripped me up, but I was far from that being corrected. Even as a sophomore in high school, I brought a note to all of the teachers beginning of the school year saying, please do not embarrass me or yourself by having me stand up and have to read anything in front of the class or to call on me in that sense, because it was a problem. So now that year, I'm in a cappella choir, one of a couple guys, probably one of the only jocks in the choir, but singing was a big part of my life growing up with our family. And they chose one year they would do, they would perform like a musical. The next year they would travel and kind of go on tour. This was a musical year. And so right out of Mr. Holland's Opus, if you've seen that movie, they had tryouts. The play was to be The Unsinkable Molly Brown. And they had tryouts Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday there in the auditorium, seated about 1,000 people. It was a big high school. And I didn't show up for any of the tryouts. I would have had no problem with the musical parts, like Mel Tillis. You don't stutter when you sing. But there is no way I could stand on a stage in front of 1,000 people and deliver any lines. I was kind of a frustrated actor. I love the idea of doing it, but there's no way. And so Thursday, we're in down to the last half hour of all of the trials, and I get a call from Mr. Cotter, who's the choir director. He had no idea I had a stuttering problem, because we had never really talked. We were always singing. He said, Dave, where are you? I said, I can't come. He said, you have to come. He said, I chose The Unsinkable Molly Brown for you to play the male lead of Leadville Johnny Brown. You have to come down. I said, I can't. I told him that I stuttered, and he totally ignored me. He said, you've got to do it. Just come down. We'll work it out. Okay. And so I did. Had my parents bring me down, came in, sung a couple bars. Fine. He's got his male lead, and here we go. I was terrified. Terrified. What am I going to do now? And so I began this regimen of training for that inevitable event of me standing to speak as this stuttering young man in front of 1,000 people for 3 nights in a row. And I guarantee you, I worked harder than anybody else worked in that production. I memorized not only my lines, but most of the other lines that were conversationally a part of what I would need to say. I put it on tape, left gaps, had my parents play the other parts, and I practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced. When I stood up that night, I did not stutter, and effectively have never stuttered since. God totally delivered me through that event. Was God capable of simply fixing my stuttering problem without my going through all that? Absolutely. So it leaves me wondering, why didn't he? Was God capable of zapping Goliath with a bolt of lightning from heaven? Absolutely. Why didn't he? Well, he didn't need to. In his providence, he sent in the most unlikely warrior anyone could imagine, a God-loving, God-fearing, poet-writing musician who looked after sheep. In comes a shepherd boy bringing sandwiches to the soldiers who happened to have a sling in his pocket. But better yet, this formerly untrained and ill-equipped teenager saw things differently. He couldn't believe his eyes and ears. Here was the mighty army of Israel, descendants of those who marched around Jericho, blowing trumpets and witnessing God crumble the walls to ashes, cowering in fear because a cross-eyed, nearsighted giant was threatening them. Could they not see that this war was an assault against the living God? By faith, David, recalling past victories against seemingly overwhelming odds, and fighting a lion and a bear in close combat, overwhelming odds, volunteered to be the champion in the fight. Everyone else thought Goliath was too big to beat. David thought he was big to miss. Everyone else was praying for a miracle. And I guarantee you David was praying too, while he picked up some rocks and ran into the battle. Everyone else came forward every day for 40 days and listened to Goliath trash talk the creator of the universe. David said, enough of that, and gave it right back to the big pagan punk. Let me wrap this up and put it into perspective, okay? Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I've got you all lathered up. I know you're going to run out and say, Hubbard said we should pick up some rocks and get in the fight. Okay, I'm being hyperbolic. I'm not talking about violence in any way, shape, and form. People will say, what would Jesus do in our situation today with what we're facing? I don't know. And I don't know that we can really say. To me, that's an irrelevant question. Why? Because Jesus didn't live in our particular situation. He didn't live in the United States of America. He didn't have a constitution and the Bill of Rights and be in a country where we're to, you know, it's a government by the people and for the people. I don't know how he would have reacted in terms of all of what's happening today. But as I see it, it's not an either or. It's an and two. I can do two things at once. I can love God, love my country, and I'm willing to fight for the right to do both. Some will say, and a lot of what I've heard is, well, look, it's the end times. And they go to Romans 1 with, you know, this is the wrath of God. And I get that. But I don't know when that's actually going to be. We've had many periods in our history where we faced very similar situations and we've fought and worked out of that and gone on. We just don't know. I'll close with this. Early in the story of Goliath, he's called a champion. That word champion in Hebrew means the following: a man between two, one who fights for everyone by engaging in a single combat. We need more men and we need more champions, or we're going to lose the battle. We're a generation that has only known freedom. Don't know who said this, but that hard times create strong people. Strong people create easy times. Easy times create weak people. Soft people create hard times.